This is Gary, and this is a podcast. It's one where I have a beer and talk at you, called I'll Have a Beer and Talk. Makes sense, right? I randomly select a craft beer, usually one I've never had before, tell you a little bit about the style, then proceed to drink it at you while I talk about a couple tech-related stories that I found on the internet that you may have missed that I thought were interesting. And I finish the show right about the time I finish the beer. Convenient. It's an accurate simulation of what it's like to hang out with me down at the pub, but you don't have to look at me. And I think that's for the best for all parties involved. To help me make that random beer selection from the obscenely vast collection down here in the I'll Have a Beer and Talk bunker, I use a thing. It's called the Randomizer! That's what you're hearing right now. It uses science to make a completely random selection for me. And the result is coming up right about now! Hooray. I shall be drinking Track 7 Brewing Company's Left Eye, Right Eye, a 9.5% ABV double IPA. India Pale Ales are so named because they were pale ales that had to be hopped up on hops to survive the long journey via sailing vessel from England to India during the late 18th century. Double IPAs are exactly what they sound like, an embiggened version of the already supremely hoppy pale ale, doubling up on its normal bitterness and alcohol levels. This is also an American double IPA, so that is also exactly what it sounds like. You guessed it, even more hops! Oh boy. How hoppy will it be? Let's switch to the beer mic and find out. Oh man, I can already smell the hoppiness, and I can even smell the resiny aspects that I'm going to be tasting in a second. This is exciting. It is a cloudy, almost orangey tan color, and with a little off-white head. And I'm really looking forward to this. I've acclimated to IPA, so let's blast my tongue with hops. It's a wonderful, strong hoppiness that's very, like, contained within and of itself. It kind of shuts off on the back end. Reminds me a little bit initially of Pliny the Elder, but more controlled. This is if you really want to try a nice super hoppy IPA and can't find Pliny the Elder, this is definitely what I would recommend going towards. So speaking of IPAs, they are not for everyone. In fact, some people don't like beer in general because of the assumption that they're all bitter, which is unfortunate because beer flavors run the gamut from super bitter to super sweet. However, for some unfortunate souls, anything excessively bitter is a turnoff. Those damned ones. Super tasters. I read about this beer disliking theory in a tiny article on Lifehacker with the clickbaity headline of, "You might hate IPAs because you're a super taster." According to Wikipedia, a super taster is a person who experiences the sense of taste with far greater intensity than average. The reason why some people can taste more intensely than the average human still eludes science. It appears that some people have an extra gene that can give a bitter flavor to the chemicals phenylthiocarbamide, aka PTC, and propylthiouracil, also known as PROP. Props. While norms don't taste anything at all when they put these chemicals on their tongue. Super tasters also seem to have a greater amount of fungiform papillae on their tongues, which are mushroom-shaped bumps on the tongue topped with taste buds. It is theorized that a biological reason for being particularly sensitive to bitter-tasting things may have been an evolutionary response, giving early humans a way to avoid potentially toxic plants given away by their bitter taste. As far as the human sense of taste is concerned, people fall into three categories. Non-tasters comprise of about 25% of all peoples, normal tasters at about 50%, and super tasters comprise that last 25%. So anything bitter tasting puts off about a quarter of the population. That makes me sad. Bitter is a great flavor. Some have it worse, though. 1% of super tasters are what could be considered super tasters. Anything even remotely bitter, even yellow fizzy domestic lager, is just too much for them to handle. And they can't even turn to liquor to get their drink on, as the burn is far too intense. If you don't like IPAs and are curious if you might be a super taster, you can order a kit for $5 from the internet. Or you can save that money for beer and grab some blue food coloring, a mirror, and a regular sheet of hole-punched paper. Squirt some of that blue on your tongue, stick it out in front of a mirror, and hold up that hole in the paper against your tongue. Count how many papillae are in that circle. If you have fewer than four, you're a non-taster. If you have 4 to 8, you are a norm. And if you have 8 or more, you just might be a super taster. Sheep know who you are, and they know what you did. Just kidding about that second part. Maybe. Gizmodo reports that according to a relatively small study from the University of Cambridge, sheep can recognize and distinguish between human faces. The study even goes so far as to claim, "These data show that sheep have advanced face recognition abilities comparable with those of humans and non-human primates." Okay. The study involved training 8 sheep to recognize images of 4 celebrities. The 4 the scientists chose? Barack Obama, Jake Gyllenhaal, Emma Watson, and Fiona Bruce. I think that says a lot about those scientists. They claim it is because there are a lot of photos of those individuals available and from lots of different angles. Sure. Then the face-trained sheep were put in pens where they had to discern between those famous faces and an object or unfamiliar face. During the experiments, the sheep went for the familiar face roughly 70% of the time, and that number increased with more training. But when the face was tilted, the propensity for going towards the familiar face dropped off, convincing the researchers that sheep perceive faces in a way similar to humans. Obviously, with small studies, these scientists' findings are taken with a grain of salt. The sheep may simply have been going towards the face with a reward. Or any other reason, really. It's just 8 sheep. So why the hell did they do this? Well, neurodegenerative diseases, such as Huntington's, harms the ability to perceive faces, and recently sheep were genetically modified to have Huntington's. If sheep do indeed recognize faces in a similar way to humans, neurologically speaking, scientists might be able to pinpoint how neurodegenerative diseases are disrupting this ability, and target medication to help sheep and humans alike. But, you know what? The sheep still know what you did. You are warned. So sheep possibly have advanced face recognition abilities comparable with those of humans and non-human primates, huh? Let's talk about those primates, because it links in with the previous story, and not just because we finally saw War for the Planet of the Apes this weekend here in the bunker. The Verge reports that new research points to the fact that chimpanzees actively attempt to warn their friends if there's a snake nearby and the friend doesn't see it. And they don't do this by patching in a weird voiceover saying,
"Watch out for snakes."
They do it by actively changing their behavior and alarm call. There seems to be more going on in chimpanzee communication, and possibly in other animal communication, especially the vocalization part, than there has been assumed possible before, said Catherine Crockford, a researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology and co-author of a study recently published in Science Advances. Crockford had observed chimps alerting each other to the presence of poisonous snakes while researching them in Uganda's Budongo Forest, and wanted to zero in on that behavior in the new study. She and her team first made some fake snakes out of chicken wire and plaster. The fake snakes were then decorated to resemble the deadly gaboon and rhinoceros vipers. Now, plaster snakes don't sound too realistic, but Crockford noted, "They were convincing enough to scare our field assistants." You know, they probably dropped them on the assistants while they were in the shower. Prank. Anyway, the researchers then located areas where chimps were expected to wander by, then set up the fake snakes and a video camera to catch the action. 1/3 of the chimps were seen to make an alarm call to other members of the group and seemed to indicate the location of the snake they found by staring in the direction of the snake, then at their companions, then back and forth, continuing to do this until the companion saw the snake as well. The researchers then used pre-recorded chimp calls in a second experiment. One recording was an alarm who, and the other was a rest who. I kind of like the sound of rest who. Anyway, as a group of chimps approached the fake snake, the chimp who heard the rest who seconds before initially spotting the snake gave more alarm calls and a back-and-forth body language than those that heard the alarm who beforehand, suggesting that when a chimp thinks its group is unaware of danger, that they need to be made aware of it immediately. The study also found that if chimps in a group had strong social bonds, such as being with friends and or family, they also gave more and stronger danger warnings. By seeing this behavior in our close primate relatives, it can give insight as to how human intercommunication evolved. I think it helps us learn much more about ourselves, how our brains work, Crockford said. Hey, if you want to make some fake snakes to fool chimps and research assistants, you don't need to use chicken wire and plaster. You could do it entirely with paper pulp, and you can do that, if you really want to, at this show's sponsor, Pulp & Deckel. Pulp & Deckel is Portland's only community handmade paperinking studio, and its mission is to keep the art of paperinking alive with workshops, demonstrations, creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products, and working with artists in creating all styles of art, including fake snakes, through the medium of papermaking. Browse a rotating selection of papermaking workshops, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the ancient art of papermaking, like making fake snakes, by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. Mention I'll have a beer and talk, and we might give you something special, like a paper fake snake. Everyone experiences what could be considered a run of bad luck at least once in their life. It's life, and you can recover from it. But you should be thankful that you weren't living 66 million years ago when probably the unluckiest event possible happened to a former resident of our planet. According to a paper published in Scientific Reports, the asteroid that hastened the dinosaur's demise happened to beat the odds and hit the planet at the exact spot that caused the most damage possible. I read about this very bad, not good dinosaur day on Gizmodo. Japanese researchers developed a new model of the chemical composition of the Earth's surface 66 million years ago, and the data says that only 13% of the surface had just the right makeup of hydrocarbons to turn the asteroid strike into a global calamity, one that probably ejected 300 gigatons of sulfur and 420 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere after the impact, encircling the globe and plunging it into a kind of prehistoric nuclear winter. The authors of the study told the New York Times that if the asteroid had struck somewhere other than where it did, the dinosaurs might still be around today. Sure they would. As always, the study was met with criticism. The study didn't even address if the cloud of debris that turned the atmosphere into a blanket was caused by the ejecta or from the smoke of the burning surface after the impact. And current research suggests that the dinosaurs were already on their way out by the time the asteroid showed up and was simply the killing blow to their dominance. Either way, it's good to know that no matter how unlucky you may feel at times, it's not as unlucky as those dinosaurs. Oh, lava lamps. I have a special connection to them. You see, back in the early 90s when I was in high school, I discovered the 60s television program The Prisoner. On the face of it, the show was about an espionage agent that resigned from his job only to be kidnapped and placed in a mysterious place called The Village, from which there was no escape, and whose master simply wanted information from him and the other people with an intelligence background being held there. There was also a huge undercurrent of anti-establishment sentiment throughout, and continually came back to the argument of society needing conformity from its citizens, sometimes aggressively so, to function, but also needing individuality to appropriately keep it moving forward and not become complacent and corrupt. Heavy stuff from my rebellious years. It having been made in the 60s, there were of course some far-out and trippy visuals, and there were lava lamps everywhere. I have a nice vintage one in my home as an homage to The Prisoner. Anyway, lava lamps are fun to look at. They are quite simple, consisting of a sealed glass bottle containing a waxy mixture and a clear or translucent liquid. The bottle rests on an incandescent light bulb in its base. As the bulb warms up, the wax starts to melt at different rates, and due to its buoyancy, rises to the surface in blobs, cools, then falls back down to the molten pile. It creates an ever-changing pattern of blobs bobbing up and down. The chaotic action of lava lamps are being used by Cloudflare, according to Boing Boing. Cloudflare is an internet security gatekeeping service that sees, quote, something like 10% of the web, end quote, flow through their network, stated by their head of cryptography, Nick Sullivan. In the lobby of their headquarters in San Francisco stands their Wall of Entropy, a roughly 24-foot-wide, 10-foot-tall series of four shelves, each shelf holding 20 lava lamps of varying colors. This is the LavaRand, a system that uses the unpredictable action of the rising and falling blobs in each lamp to provide a secondary source of randomness for their security servers. A camera trained on the wall feeds the waxy bobbings into a server, and from that server come the random numbers that they might need. Randomness is essential for security and cryptography, as it creates codes that are unpredictable, making it more difficult for hackers and their software to break encryption. Cloudflare has an effective primary system for generating randomness, but better safe than sorry, and the LavaRand is pretty to look at, so it will remain active as a backup if needed. Business Insider, never one to pass up a clickbaity headline, published this story entitled, "Science Has Proven That You're a Better Person If You Like Harry Potter. Here's Why." So, of course, I had to find out why. A study was published in the Journal of Applied Social Psychology that stated that those who are emotionally attached to the world and characters of Harry Potter are less likely to be prejudiced against minority groups. If you've been frozen for the past 20 or so years, the Harry Potter series of fantasy books tells the story of a young orphan boy who is invited to attend a wizarding school, and throughout the book struggles to defeat the evil dark wizard Voldemort, who was responsible for his parents' death, and wishes to purge the world of those not of, quote, pure blood. The books, aimed at children but loved by people of all ages, have overarching themes of kindness towards others despite differences, and there is a heavy emphasis on prejudice being associated with evil. The study gathered 34 school children and gave them a questionnaire about how they felt about immigrants. Then the children were split into two groups. One group read a scene in which Draco Malfoy, an evil character, called Hermione, one of the main good characters, a, quote, filthy little mudblood, which is a derogatory term in their world to describe people with magical ability born from those without. And the other group of children read scenes with no references to prejudice, such as Harry finding and purchasing his first magic wand. A week later, the children were asked again how they felt about immigrants. The group that identified with Harry Potter and read the prejudice passage significantly improved their attitude towards immigrants, compared to how they felt based on the questionnaire, and the group that read the non-prejudicial passages had no change in their attitudes. In follow-up experiments, groups of young adults were asked how they felt about minorities before and after reading similar passages. High school students were found to have better attitudes towards homosexuals after the reading, and college students had more compassion for refugees. The study's lead author, Dr. Loris Vazali from the University of Modena, had this to say. Harry Potter empathizes with characters from stigmatized categories, tries to understand their sufferings, and to act towards social equality. So I and my colleagues think that empathetic feelings are the key factor driving prejudice reduction. The world of Harry Potter is characterized by strict social hierarchies and resulting prejudices, with obvious parallels with our society. Adding, Harry has meaningful contact with characters belonging to stigmatized groups. He tries to understand them and appreciate their difficulties, some of which stem from the intergroup discrimination, and fights for a world free of social inequalities. So we should all attend wizarding school or read Harry Potter. It'll make the world a better place. You know, I keep thinking about those chimps making snake alarm calls.
Watch out for snakes!
Probably because that's not the only animal warning cries I read about this week. Gizmodo informed me that pigeons have a very special whistling alarm, and it's created by their wings. Crested pigeons, also known as Ossifaps lophotes, let's hear you try to say that fast, are found throughout mainland Australia. They're also known for a spike-like tower of feathers on their head, and for making a distinct sound by flapping their wings. Now, I cannot take credit for this following joke. It was written by the writer of this article, Jake Bueller. Ready? This is what it sounds like when doves fly. Until recently, it was not understood if the sound was just a byproduct of their feathers or if the pigeons used it for communication. Because birds have a far more audible form of communication through their song, the idea that the feather noise could also be used for communication didn't garner much attention for research. Until now! A research team at the Australian National University thought it was possible the pigeons were using their whistling wings to play a role in nonverbal communication, potentially as an alarm signal to other members of their flock. The results of their work have been published in a study in Current Biology. If the whistling behavior had evolved to be a signal, then the pigeons would have a physical adaptation specifically devoted to making that sound. By analyzing the acoustics of the sound and examining their wings, the researchers discovered that one flight feather, specifically the eighth one out from the shoulder on each wing, was roughly half the width of the others. This feather, dubbed P8, seemed to be the source of the sound. By removing the feather from test subjects, the whistling's high notes were completely changed, suggesting that P8 was definitely involved in creating the sound along with the other feathers. They then ran experiments to see if pigeons had some degree of control over the sound of the whistling. The researchers paid attention to the wings during three different flight situations: normal flight, casual flight, and escape flight. Escape flights resulted in faster wing beats than the other two states and created a high-tempo whistling sound much different from the sound from the other two flight modes, and it also increased in intensity based on the threat level. The final test to see if the pigeons did indeed use this ability to sound the alarm involved playing back recordings of the alarm flight from pigeons with their P8 feathers intact, as well as recordings of the alarm flight from pigeons with their P8 feathers removed. Can you guess what happened? The pigeons hearing the intact P-8 alarm flight freaked out, where the group hearing the P-8 featherless flights just sat there. So by evolution, the crested pigeons created a pretty reliable alarm call, one that would be hard to make accidentally, as a pigeon would have to be genuinely in distress to make it. Go pigeons! Hello, everyone! This show is not only supported by Pulp and Deckle, it's supported by listeners just like you! You're a listener like you, right? If you get value or entertainment from the show, maybe you too would like to support me? I'm Ron Burgundy. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckle.com. That is GARY@PULPANDDECKLE.com. Rates are reasonable. And if you could be so kind to rate and review the show on iTunes, the more iHabat's discoverability will go up for people looking for beery tech podcasts on iTunes. And you can also support the show directly with money. I like money. If you enjoy my show each week, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/iHabitRadio. That is patreon.com/iHabitRadio. Go to patreon.com/iHabitRadio and become my patron. You can be really funky, and you'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. You won't be alone. There's people there. Believe me. I couldn't do it without you. Oh, my left eye and right eye are a little blurry now, thanks to this left eye, right eye double IPA. But unfortunately, I finished it. Oh well, that means it's time for me to go. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and fake snakes about the show, and they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to gary@pulpanddeckle.com or on the Twitters and Instagram at iHabitRadio. Or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHabitRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!
Watch out for snakes.